so many train wrecks, but I thought, God, Brooke, if you don't have something that's your own, it's all going to be constantly picked apart and taken away.
Hey everyone, welcome to Ladies First with Laura Brown. I'm Laura Brown, editor-in-chief of InStyle magazine. Each week, I'm talking to a legendary lady about what she does, how she does it, and what we can learn from her. We're taking a break this week, but I am resharing my conversation with the one and only Brooke Shields. Listen to this. This lady did her first modeling job when she was 11 months old. She made her first movie when she was 11 years old. And you know, I wanted to know what sort of perspective a life like that gives you. So I asked. And wee, did she answer. Welcome to Ladies First, Brooke Shields, in which I talk to women who are first in what they do. And guess what, Brooke Shields, you're one of them. I was actually just telling our producer about how we met, because it's a sentence that one doesn't normally say. We met at a party that Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes hosted for David and Victoria Beckham when they moved to Los Angeles. I haven't said that sentence probably since then. And we're at this sort of hangar warehouse thing in LA.
It was an airplane hangar in LA. And everywhere you looked, it was like more famous person than the next more famous person.
I remember going to get some shrimp or something and going, oh, Bruce Willis. But we're at this thing. You're dancing and I'm dancing. And I mean this as a, like, maybe a compliment to us. We were dancing like dickheads.
Dickheads. Like two dickheads, which are always like, better than one.
We were dancing in this kind of circle. And, you know, as one does, because that's what girls do. I don't know why. And just like absolute fools.
The problem about the circle was people kept leaving the circle and you and I kept staying in it. So it became a more of a line of two.
Yeah, and I remember going, wow, Brooke Shields is a dickhead.
Is a dickhead.
And I immediately adored you. I just was like, Brooke Shields is a human lady who's not living in a bunker with long nails and peeing in a bottle, which you very much could be after your life, but you haven't.
There's time.
I remember thinking, this is a human lady who is in her own self and in her own bones and not being self-conscious when it is the thing that you could have done more readily than anybody else. And that is what I admire about you.
You know, when you're younger, it's all about, okay, next thing, what am I going to do? I got to do this, I got to do that. And you kind of keep going. So in that party, for instance, you walk into that party and it's a lot of pressure. Do you look enough this way? Do you look enough that way? It's a feeding frenzy, especially in Los Angeles. I thought, okay, this is so bizarre, but I'm here and I got invited, so I'm going to have fun. And I think I've done that with every single situation because it's how you stay in it, but separate. I always had another life. None of it was my whole life. Like, I always had school. I always lived in New York. My mom, she always made the company that I was working with have me travel with either my stepsister or a best friend. So I always had someone my age with me. So there was always a point of anchoring. So I would look at all this craziness and think, this isn't my real life.
But that's what I think about when I think of you as perspective. Do you remember a first instance or something of perspective, even at a very, very young age?
I remember even as far back as Pretty Baby and thinking on the one hand that this was such a beautiful, creative movie that was so luscious. And this felt like something that was extraordinary. In addition, it was my first real film, but I remember looking at the other actresses and watching them be so vulnerable and sad and needy and broken and having relationships with people. One girl got pregnant, had to have an abortion. One was sleeping with this person and another person. And I watched people's behavior get so caught up into this thing that was going to leave them in 3 months.
Right.
Also, I watched and I thought, I don't ever want to become a sad, lonely actress. You know, I mean,
at 11 years old.
There were beautiful women that are, you know, that thriving today and gorgeous and have families, and, you know, and it's not a comment on them. It was a comment on the vulnerability that this whole business incites, gets you to be, and then doesn't take care of you. So it goes, open up, vulnerable, we're going to steal it. And then we're going to let you go. And then you're just a raw nothing. I didn't want to live my life like that. I wanted to be funny. I wanted to have joy. I wanted to make people laugh. And so that was sort of in my nature.
You didn't know then at 11, but you played the long game.
I did. I don't know how I had the foresight. I guess I saw so many train wrecks and I thought, God, Brooke, if you don't have something that's your own, it's all going to be constantly picked apart and taken away. And that's why I think I was so adamant about having children and being married and having a house and, you know. And
anchor.
Yeah, because I was so afraid of being left hanging with nothing. So it's like you go into a party like that, there's nothing anchoring about that. It's all based on comparison and fabulousness and what you're not and what you don't have and how little you are comparatively, you know. And so it's like, okay, what's my anchor?
But it says everything about how in your bones you are, that in that environment that could chip away at you, you can just sit there on the dance floor and just go for it. But also, perspective on being seen as a raging beauty. How did you gain perspective on that?
So, wouldn't look in the mirror. Was so afraid of being vain, so afraid of ego, so afraid of celebrating anything that anybody else was sort of, I thought, maybe projecting onto me. What if it wasn't real? Like, so I would sit and make up, and I always brought my homework in, and I did all my homework, and I never looked in the mirror. I never looked at my hair. And they'd say, well, what do you think? And I'd go, it's great. What was I supposed to say? Like, oh, it's great. I look beautiful. I got a ton of makeup on. Is that beautiful? I don't know. Does it look? No, get me out on set and let me act the character of whoever we're shooting for. That I can do. But then it kind of came back to bite me in the ass when I was in dance class. Because in order to be in dance class, you have to
look at yourself.
And I couldn't do it. And I would fall on my face. I would fall every time I tried to pirouette or do a turn or something. And I had a teacher come over to me and he's like, what's the matter with you? He goes, I don't know why you care. He's like, everybody else is looking at themselves. And I thought, oh wait, they are, so maybe I can. But the sort of concept of somehow buying into this thing of beauty seemed so, it was abstract to me.
Yeah.
You know, how do you take a face of anybody, put it on the cover of Time magazine and say, this is the look of an era? But it seemed so not grounded in anything, you know?
Yeah.
And hard to live up to be honest, you know?
Did you feel you had to sort of overcompensate for that and be like, no, I'm one of you guys. I'm fun too.
Oh, I lived in self-deprecation at its height, probably until just recently. It works in some situations. Make yourself smaller so that other females in particular don't hate you before they've even gotten to know you. And it's a good tool to a certain extent. It can really serve you. The problem with it is done over time, you start to believe all of the self-deprecation. So you then opt for, I'm slightly less, I'm always less than, oh, I'm the clown. And I made myself so much smaller that it's taken me a while to be the bigger part of myself and own all of it, you know? And it's very tricky, but one of the things like that I'm just professing these days is living your biggest life doesn't mean arrogance. It doesn't mean superiority. It doesn't mean not lifting up your fellow female, you know? It just means we all have so much more. Shine it.
It's ownership. Did you have to go, okay, quit it?
I have to watch myself even today. It's really only been in the last I want to say 10 years that the idea has started to really germinate. And I've said to myself, enough is enough. Stop already. Come on, what are you waiting for? You think someone's going to come out of the sky and go, no, this, I'm going to give you the wand. No, you have your own wand and you got to put it on yourself and sort of say like, stop. It's just, it's not, doesn't work anymore. It doesn't fit. It's not comfortable for other people. It's not cute.
It's a shtick. And I know I push women all the time to say, what are you, you know, what are you proud of? And I've had talked to women, famous actresses, whatever. I don't like the word pride. There's too much ego in it. What are you ambitious for? Oh, ambition. I don't like that word.
I think women are taught that. Just be the little lady in the corner. We're talking about decades and decades and decades and decades of this being nurtured. You can't be a strong businesswoman. You're the bitch. And we get associated with that. I mean, I used to think humility was the best word ever. But when you really look at it, you have to be careful. Humble, I get. And I will always not think my time is worth more than someone else's. But what I've always done with those words is go up in a little ball, make myself smaller so that other people could be bigger. And that is just toxic.
And oftentimes the word humility is used so disingenuously in these fields. Oh, thank you for the biggest award ever. Oh, yes, I'm so humbled. You just won an Oscar. But I think I remember Issa Rae said this. She got up there and went, yeah, I'm good at this. So what are you ambitious for?
Oh, I am more ambitious now than I think I've ever been. During the pandemic, I was able to go to Scotland and do a movie for Netflix. That reignited in me everything that I know I love to do, which is perform. And I think that to be this age, to be 55 and to feel like I'm just beginning, to feel physically stronger, sexier in my body, I feel like my kids are—they're good. I just feel I'm working on creating a just an extraordinary platform, and I feel very passionate about it. So I'm ambitious creatively in a way that I used to possibly think was selfish, and now I just think it's my time, and I feel blessed. But I want more, and I'm ready for it now.
And not to do it with a disclaimer.
And, you know, not apologizing for it. And I want to do more and affect my life and other people's lives and just be as big as I possibly can.
Back to Ladies First with me, Laura Brown. I'm talking to Brooke Shields about how she's kept such great perspective throughout her career, despite being in show business before she could walk. But tell me what, through your career, what you've been proudest of achievement-wise, and obviously, and then we'll get to family.
What I did on stage in Wonderful Town, to me, it all culminated in one of the best performances, I think, of my life. And I did it almost a year and 8 times a week. And the extraordinary feat of doing something that physical, something that had that range in it. And then the cherry on the top was I got extremely wonderful reviews from the same reviewers who had just, you know, destroyed, eviscerated me for 30 years. So I'm the most proud of going into the shoes of someone who got the Tony nomination. The challenge of going into a Broadway show like that was really, I'm a student though. I'm really a student, like of anything and everything.
Before, so tell me about personally, family, proudest things to date.
Well, prior to family, just going to university and getting a degree was unheard of. You know, I mean, Jody, I was the only one that had done it, and Jennifer Beals, and to do, and for it to be an Ivy League and get honors, and I walked off that campus so fortified, and the press that didn't really love that I had an education now because my answers were different. It also made me know that the industry that I loved so much, that was so tenuous, if God forbid it got taken away in any way, I had enough to pivot.
You have had a way, especially with your book about fertility and everything else, is you have a great universality to the way that you communicate. That seems like it came naturally to you, but when you were writing these books, were you conscious of that, or were you just like, this happened to me?
I think that because my history with the public and with people has always stemmed from, there was always so much access to me. Oh, she had her period. Oh, she lost her virginity. Oh, she had her braces on. And so you sit there going like, man, they've got a lot to say about all those things like in my life.
Yeah.
You know? And you think, God, wow, really? Okay. Well, here's an idea. I'm going to tell you what really happened. You're already going to say something about it, so I might as well beat them to it, you know? And then the reaction to it was so positive and helpful to me and to women and to, you know, my children.
How does it inform you as a mom?
I'm proud of the women that they are, that I am getting out of their way, giving them enough of the tools and the guidance and the freedom to be who they are, but the knowledge that I have acquired and sharing that as a parent. You know, so it's not just letting them run amok. I'm proud of the fact that I'm giving them freedom. I'm not making my need of their approval so strong that I hinder them or that I'm their burden, you know? And I lived in that kind of a parental, my mother's whole life depended on me and I loved her to death and felt loved and blah, blah, blah. But I don't want them to be burdened with worrying and I want them to love me and, you know, be proud of me, but I'm not their problem, you know?
And you're very conscientious about parenting too. And to have teenage girls that you're not all strangling each other is an incredible victory. So, you know.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
It's exhausting and it's miraculous when you have a day that didn't have tears.
Yeah. That's also going to be just qualified as that pandemic life. We're talking in January 2021 and this has been happening since March 2020. How have you managed to get through emotionally, intellectually yourself?
It was an unbelievable 6-7 straight months of just being under one roof. And it was in ways glorious because we were afraid together, we laughed together, we were angry together, we had fun together, we got bored together, but we also came out of it together. And I don't know how much of that is long lasting for teenagers, but I do know that as a mom, knowing that very soon they will be out of my house, having that kind of uninterrupted time. It wasn't all bliss and doing puzzles and, you know, doing TikToks. Yeah, there were those and they were great. But the most boring and annoying times, sometimes I looked at them and I thought, you have to be in the house with me. You can't see your friends. I was like, I have you captive. Physically, I took, like I do usually do with everything, I took the one thing that I could have control over. Because I couldn't have control, and the fear of not having control, especially for a Gemini, is like, it's mind-blowing. So I took control of the physical.
No, but it's true. If you can control something, and if it's your own physical health, you know, and not be overtaken by
the
circumstance.
Well, of course, the first part of it. Yeah. Was all drinking and all eating. Like,
yeah.
I drank every day starting at like 11.
Nice. efficient.
Because it was justifiable. I drank a lot and I ate a lot. And then all of a sudden I thought, okay, now let's try to find balance in all of this. So that's what happened.
Okay, 10 firsts. It's just 10 cheeky little questions. Number one, first drink you order.
A margarita. Not sweet.
Salt or no?
No salt, not sweet. And I've been, I actually do a Tommy's margarita, which is what they call them in London.
How many can you have though? I had three margaritas the next day. I thought I was going to die.
I think people are built differently. I can have my constitution. It's just in my history. I can definitely handle exorbitant amounts. I'm currently not drinking, which has been kind of not fun, but I feel much better. But I can drink at least three or four of those just as a start.
Brooke's knowledge of the constitution of herself is unparalleled. Okay. First thing you look at on your phone in the morning?
My texts.
Then what else?
And then emails. I do not go first to Instagram. I cannot do it first thing in the morning. I have to start my day, get everything, you know, settle in, and then I'll check it mid-afternoon.
What's your worst online habit?
Shopping on Amazon. I just love equipment. I love things. I love things in kitchens that do things, and my husband is the opposite. He's like, do not get me something that has one function. I don't want it in this kitchen. Because you don't need a rice cooker. You got a pot. I'm like, but I can put the rice cooker on and I can walk away. And he goes, how about putting rice in a pot and staying there?
He's right. Okay. First person you call.
First person I call when I'm home with everybody?
Yeah.
My agent. Business-wise, I'll always, like, I get up and I have to know what my day is. So I need to know what I have to do. I don't start enjoying my phone time until mid-afternoon, and then I go for the girlfriends. But you know what? But what I do a lot is text. Like, I'll text you in the middle of the night so that when you wake up in the morning, you'll have my text.
Okay. First joke you remember?
First joke I remember was a joke my mother told. It was about a woman coming home and saying to her husband, you know, I saw the doctor today, and he said I had the nicest legs. And the husband's going, And he said I had beautiful hair, And he said that I was just had the softest skin, Trying to get a rise out of him. And he said I had the most luscious lips, And he says, hey, did he say anything about your fat ass? And she says, no, your name was never mentioned. That is a joke my mother told me when I was a child.
That's a perfect mom of a certain, like, you know, era.
Yeah, your name was never mentioned, fat ass. Yeah, that was a joke I seem to always remember.
Okay, first fashion splurge.
An Hermes bag.
Oh.
When I was doing Lipstick Jungle, yeah, I got a Birkin.
What color?
It was actually Kelly Green.
Oh!
I know. I probably should have gotten like black, but I went in and the only one that they had that was the size that I could buy was like a really sharp green. And it's so priced, it's so pretty.
You,
I love it.
Do you carry it around anywhere lately? Like, who even uses a handbag these days? Yes.
I used it more when I was in LA because you had to get in and out of the car. But yeah, I don't know. I love accessories.
I know you do. Whenever I see it, it's like, oh, so this ring I've got, these earrings. Glamour. Okay, first time you owned your shit.
First time I owned my shit? Oh, God. I was probably 9.
Go on.
I was already doing movies when I was that age. And I was like, I got it. I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm going to own it.
Okay. First date.
First date was with Jimmy McNichol. We're in California. And I think we went to the Bel Air Hotel and we were like walking by the pond. And I thought like, oh, maybe he's going to kiss me. And I had my back to the water, and the swans are really mean. And literally, the swan came out of the water and started running after me and attacking me, and we never had the kiss, and that was it.
If you ever get to know Brooke here and you wheel out some of your date stories.
That'll be a separate book.
Okay, first thing you turn on TV.
I turn on the news. I turn on CNN.
And then we just flagellate ourselves. Fair enough. First thing you do or eat if you're stressed.
Stressed? I'm not a stress eater. I'm probably more of a stress drinker. I don't have the comfort, I'm going to go eat a pint of ice cream.
Do you, something you do if you're stressed out? Is it something you say to yourself, or you need to like lie down, or?
I need to like do some crazy kind of like spin class, like a soul cycle class or something. I need to obliterate. I need to get so tired. I'm like those like, you know, little kids that, you know, that just need to run or like absolutely, I need to make it so that I almost can't stand up straight, because otherwise I just get wound and wound and tighter and tighter and tighter.
Okay, two left. First car you bought?
A Chrysler LeBaron.
Ooh.
Convertible. And it was this little car, and I went to go buy it, and they ended up giving it to me because I took a picture in a little Valentino sweater leaning on it, and then they recalled them because like the brakes went out or something. So I was like, God giveth, God taketh.
I think that's just an analogy for the whole your celebrity life.
My mother would always say, there ain't nothing for free. She'd say there's no such thing as a free lunch. She goes, just watch. Everything they give you for free, they'll want blood. It's sort of true. And I'm yet to totally learn that lesson.
But I just love how anything we speak about in terms of your history ends up being in some sort of like mafioso accent. No, it's like, then I saw it. And then mom said.
She was from Newark. Mom was from Newark.
But like, your whole theme of like your earlier recollections is in the vein of, I've seen some shit.
Look at the gams on that girl.
Okay, last one. First thing you'll do when this pandemic is over.
Oh, just go out to just to dinner and I don't know. I kind of want to go somewhere and dance with my friends. I just want to like go and just socialize, and I want to hug. I want hugs. I want.
Yeah, just climb on random people.
I don't think we're meant to be so isolated.
On that note, again, why I admire you is because you've not isolated yourself from anything, and you're never going to, and you have completely lived your life in an open, honest, and edifying way, again, when you could have been peeing in bottles.
Who's to say I haven't?
Just, I don't want to see what's downstairs. I'm going to assume it's not. But thank you for all you do, and I can't wait to see what you're up to next. As your friend and fan, I can't wait. So thank you for doing this little podcast.
I'm so glad you're doing it. I'm so proud of you, if I can say that, and happy for you, and it's only the beginning.
Thanks for eavesdropping on me and Ms. Shields this week. Hope you join us next time for my conversation with Ellen Pompeo. She's just what the doctor ordered.
This has been Ladies First with Laura Brown. We can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to follow us so you don't miss an episode, and we'd love your feedback. If you could please rate us and leave us a review, oh, we'd love it. Thanks to our production team at Pod People, Rachel King, Matt Sav, Danielle Roth, Anne Ford, Anne Kane, and Erica Wong. And thanks to Brian Asdy, Molly Stout, and Hayley Mason at InStyle. You can find out more at InStyle.com and find us on Instagram at InStyle Magazine, on Twitter at InStyle, and you can find me on Insta and Twitter at Laura Brown 99. See you next week for more Ladies First with Laura Brown.